what happens when they go out of control, and how we should cultivate opposite tendencies to control the senses, and ultimately take good association, and how that association is a good association of devotees is the activities are there, but in relation to different types of devotees, they're performed in a little different manner. In other words, we have acting towards superiors, towards equals, and towards inferiors. So there's a slight different method in treating the different devotees. Nevertheless, there's always exchange of some sort going on between devotees. So, and we discuss the different types of devotees also. That's devotional association. So obviously, devotional association is very important here. And consequently, to in any way obstruct or prevent that association or to damage that association is considered very harmful to devotional service. This is what we call Vaishnava Aparad. Satsanga means association with Vaishnavas favorably. We think favorably of Vaishnavas when we associate and we get spiritual benefit. So Vaishnava Aparad means we think badly of Vaishnava and therefore we don't get any spiritual benefit. Rather, we get spiritual harm or damage. Not only we don't benefit, but we get damage also as a result of this. So that is what Vaishnava Aparad is. Of course, there are all sorts of aparads. Bhaktivinoda classifies aparads into four types of aparads, which don't act to destroy, but they may obstruct or weaken the process of bhakti. In other words, they are anarthas at one stage. They become destructive when they become more intense. When they're done out of, let's say, unintentional thing or ignorance, and they're not so bad. They just, let's say, cover bhakti, like ignorance covers bhakti. So he mentions four types of aparads. That is, seva aparad, nam aparad, vaishnava aparad, and jiva aparad. Four different categories. Generally, we actually, in nam aparad, it includes everything also, because we have vaishnava aparad in there also. But in nam aparad, or ten aparad, in our nam aparad, in there, everything is somehow related to the holy name, so we call it nam aparad. But Bhaktivinoda's method is a little different because he's emphasizing aparad can have different objects of offense. In other words, seva aparad is the offenses in deity worship. These are mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion. Rupa Goswami quotes some different Puranas and he gives a different aparad against the deity, like wearing shoes into the deity room, or using foul language in front of the deities, or offering forbidden things to the deity, or touching the deity in an unclean state. This is called seva aparad. It's deity seva aparad. So this is offense against the Lord himself. Now, of course, we could also have offense against not the deity form, but of course the actual form of the Lord, but we can't see him. So generally we don't commit offense there. But we do have a deity form of the Lord, so we can commit offense to him. So these are called seva aparads. Now generally these aparads are not so serious for the devotee, because generally he doesn't do them on purpose. He may do them unintentionally or inadvertently, something like that, but he's not intentionally going to run in the room with his shoes on just to insult the deity. He may walk through out of ignorance or when he's in a hurry, but he's not going to just insult the deity by wearing shoes in the deity room. So generally we may commit these aparads more out of negligence or something, or ignorance, than anything else. So they don't have such a detrimental effect upon the practicing devotee, because we do have some seriousness in worshiping Krishna with. By accident we may do. So that's not so serious. Of course, now it's fun, like the Mayavadi, they think the deity is simply a material object which we use and then throw away. So that is aparad, a real aparad against the deity. That's very offensive attitude towards the deity form of the Lord. So anyway, have offense against the Lord himself. That's the one. And then we have offense against the process of bhakti. That is namaparad. By our namaparad, we mean chanting the holy name and all the other processes of bhakti also, like hearing, chanting, remembering, deity worship, etc. So namaparad includes all those. So it means basically the processes of bhakti, the different angas of bhakti, aparad there, offense. So those offenses are, we have of course the ten aparads, the namaparads are there, in relation to the chanting of the holy name. So the person who gives the holy name, if you offend that Vaishnava, then that's an aparad. If you offend the scriptures, which are glorifying the holy name, then that's an aparad. If you think of the holy name's potency as imaginary or exaggeration, it's not real, it's, you know, it's just something that somebody made up, then it is offensive. Or if we think that the results of chanting are similar to karma, material, not spiritual, then it's, you know, aparad. In other words, we deny the spiritual potency of the holy name, and we think it is something material. And we disrespect the scriptures about the holy name and the people who give the holy name and the guru who gives teachings about the holy name. Everything related to the holy name. Ultimately, the holy name in any other process, anything related to the process, that is called aparad. We disrespect in any way. And then we have Krishna. We have the process of bhakti that Krishna gives, and the process is given not by Krishna directly, but through the devotee. So then, that's also an aparad we can make. It's a major aparad because sadhu sangha is the main process. So Vaishnava aparad is put in a separate category by itself. It's a very important category, the Vaishnava aparad. So that's the third category. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur also has another category called Jiva Aparad. That is offenses against jivas in general who aren't Vaishnavas. So that is also considered to be detrimental to spiritual development. That is reflected to some degree in the angas of bhakti. One anga is we should respect the trees and the cows and the brahmanas and like that. And the other is we should not disturb unnecessarily other living entities. That's the 19th anga of bhakti. So there is something similar as there. So that's jiva aparad in general. And of course in the angas of bhakti, Krishna mentioned, or Rupa Goswami mentions, don't offend the devatas, don't offend other living entities, don't offend the Vaishnavas, don't offend the acharyas, don't offend the scriptures. He gives many rules like that as angas of bhakti also. Therefore, there are four different types of aparads, or offense against the Krishna, the devotee of Krishna, and the scripture that delivers the process of bhakti, and the processes of bhakti themselves, and jivas in general. So, of all of those, the Lord Chaitanya singles out the Vaishnava aparad as the most damaging of all, and this is the most harmful one of all of them. The seva aparads generally don't have so much effect on us because we're not intentionally committing them. But the Vaishnava aparad is very damaging, actually. And all these aparads are hostility towards, some sort of hostility towards devotional service and the Supreme Lord in some way or other. Whereas sinful activity is not hostility towards anything devotional as such. It is just indulging in uncontrolled sense gratification, which may in the process harm other living entities. But it is not directed against Krishna directly or against the devotees or the process of bhakti. So therefore, it is not harmful in the same way. In other words, sin can give you suffering in terms of karma, but it doesn't necessarily destroy bhakti. Whereas aparads can do that because they are, we're acting against the process of bhakti and against the Lord and against the Vaishnava. Huh? So aparads have devotional effect. They harm our faith. Whereas sin can, of course, indulge us in sense gratification, but doesn't necessarily decrease our, whatever faith we've attained. So, of the two things, the aparada is more harmful than the sinful activity, because it's directly against devotional items. Nevertheless, the aparadas themselves are classified by Bhaktivinoda Thakur as anartha. Not that they destroy, but they can, let's say, slow down the process of bhakti under normal circumstances. That is, we're not being hostile, but we may do by accident or inadvertently. But when the attitude becomes directly hostile, then it becomes aparada with a capital A, which is very destructive. It's not just slowing down bhakti, but it can actually destroy bhakti. That's when there is overt malice or hostility towards the process of bhakti or Krishna or the Vaishnava. Then it becomes quite destructive. It's very harmful. So all the aparadas can do that, but the most serious one is the Vaishnava aparada. So Lord Chaitanya says that is like the mad elephant. The other aparadas are there and they're also destructive, but the Vaishnava aparada is such that it can wipe out bhakti, which you may have spent maybe 20 lifetimes accruing just to get a little faith and then do a little something, and then by serious Vaishnava aparada, that could all wipe out, and you have to start all over for another 20 lifetimes to get it back again. So it's like as a mad elephant steps on a little plant and it destroys it, so the Vaishnava aparada can also destroy whatever bhakti has sprouted in the soul, and it can disappear completely. So there is some reasons for that, of course. As we've been reading in the morning, the Supreme Lord is very affectionate towards his devotee, and actually he gives himself to his devotees, and he also gives his shakti to his devotees to preach in this material world. So he empowers the devotees to give out his mercy in this material world. So we may not be able to see Krishna directly or sense him, but we can meet devotees and we can get mercy from them. That's Krishna's mercy, but it's through the devotees we can get it. So therefore the devotees act as the representative of Krishna in this material world. Just like we can't understand the voltage in the powerhouse somewhere, wherever it is. But when we see the light bulb, we can understand what it is. It's coming out on this end, and we see it's manifested as light. So this is a materialization of the electricity coming from the powerhouse. So in the same way, the devotee acts as a medium of the Lord's mercy, and it comes out through the devotee, and that's how practically we can get in this material world and understand what his mercy is through the devotee. So just like the electricity is coming out the light bulb and it's conducted by a wire that goes back somewhere to the powerhouse or wherever it comes from, like that. So Krishna is there and he has his mercy, and it comes through the devotee and comes out the devotee into the material world. And of course the light bulb goes everywhere and distributes its light, so the devotee is also like that. He distributes generously. However, some people pick it up and some people don't. Some people will stay in the light and some people stay in the dark. So some people will also get the mercy and take it and take advantage of it, and some won't. That's like the example of Christ gives the example of the seeds falling on the barren land, and the seeds falling in the wet land, and the seeds falling in the fertile field. So those that seeds that fall in the fertile field sprout. Those that fall on the barren land don't sprout. Those that fall in the wet land rot. And it's only those that get on the fertile field. So then the mercy is there, but people who are ready for it, then they'll accept. In other words, fertile field means they have a little faith already. and they get that mercy and they accept it, and then the sprout begins to grow. So the fertile field is the heart which has faith, has some faith in the Lord. So faith is the qualification for sprouting bhakti. So anyway, the mercy comes through the devotee. So if the devotee is not there, Krishna's mercy doesn't manifest, unless he comes personally as avatar, which is very rare. But otherwise, it's very difficult to get the mercy. Scripture is also there, but generally we have to get the scripture through the devotee also. So therefore, the devotee is a very important link in Krishna's whole process of distributing his mercy in this world. And without that link, nothing happens. Nothing happens to the jiva. He won't progress. So if we cut off our link, we don't recognize the devotee, then how are we going to dance? Because only when we get the mercy of the devotee, continual mercy, of course we can get causeless mercy, and this falls on us, Agyapa Sukriti. But if we want to actually get mercy on a continuous basis, then we have to follow, as it says here, how we conduct ourselves in relation to devotees. With Uttam, Madhyam, and Kanishta. This is a process of conduct. And if we don't follow that conduct, we don't get the mercy. So therefore we have to treat the devotee in the proper way with proper respect, and then the process works. So it is like water flows from high place to a low place like that. And we'll put it up here and it goes down the hill, down like that. So the devotee has mercy and knowledge, spiritual knowledge, and he can give that to a person who has faith. But that person has to have certain qualifications also. So one of them is humility. So therefore that's the first instruction in the Nectar of Devotion. The first Anga Bhakti is Guru Parasraya. One has to surrender. And Krishna also says in Bhagavad Gita, Pranipatena, Pariprasnena, Sevaya. So Pranipat means to fall down, to be humble. So humility is necessary to get knowledge. If we are proud, we cannot get knowledge because we think we know already. So we have to think, I don't know anything. So we have to surrender completely and give up our pride completely. Then we're qualified for the knowledge. Knowledge can come down to us. If we're up here, we can't get the knowledge. If we surrender, then we can get the knowledge. It will flow down to us when we're in a humble state. And we have to be eager for the knowledge, therefore Pariprasanna is important. We may be humble, but we don't want having spiritual interest, and what's the point? So you can be humble in the material world, but not for getting spiritual knowledge. So you have to also have the spiritual thirst. Or we could be humble and be Mayavadi also, so that's not going to be useful. So we have to be inquisitive about Krishna. Wanting to know about Krishna. So that Pariprasanna is important, to ask about Krishna. And we also have to not just listen, we have to be active. We have to follow the instructions. We have to follow the teachings. So that's where seva is. Seva means we institute the instructions properly and serve properly. And in relation to the devotee or the guru, then one has to serve. That's mentioned in the previous verse. For the superior Vaishnava, then you should serve him. But of all the services, one can serve the Bapu. There's two types of service. Bapu service and Vani Seva. We can serve the instruction, we can serve the body. Both are considered necessary. One should serve, do both. So therefore one can clean the room of the devotee or the guru, or cook for him or whatever like that. Narottam did that for Lokanath. He cleaned up the stool area every day for 1 year or whatever, long period of time. And then he got the mercy of Lokanath Goswami, and he got initiated by him by doing that manual, a menial service for a long time, silently. So menial service is there. But even more important than that is to follow the instructions of the guru. If we do the menial service and we don't follow what he says, what's the use? We're very humble, we serve, and we do everything, but we don't chant Hare Krishna, what's the use? So we have to follow the instruction also. But importantly, the instruction, the big instruction there is, the ultimate instruction is given in the purport of the Bhagavad Gita, that verse that Prabhupada was inspired by when he decided that now I will dedicate myself to following the order of Guru. This is in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita, that one should have, you know, unflinching faith and determination to follow the Krishna. There it says Krishna. But then in the purport, Vishnu says, one should follow the order of the Guru as if it were one's life-sustaining medicine. And if you don't take the medicine, then you die. If you don't follow the order of the Guru, your spiritual life is finished. But then he says, what is the order of the Guru? The particular order, he says, is that one should serve the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. That's the order of the Guru, the final order. Now, there was too many orders, but ultimately, hear and chant and remember everything, but ultimately it is to develop love of Radha and Krishna and serve the lotus feet. That's the ultimate order of the Guru. In other words, the prayojana, the highest goal, is what the Guru is teaching. So therefore, we have to serve that order and try to achieve that. That's the whole goal of surrendering to the spiritual master, so we can achieve the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. So he says that is the final order or instruction given, that we should serve their lotus feet like life-sustaining medicine. Without that, then we're finished. So anyway, that's the Vani Seva, and we have to follow the instructions. Seva is there. So we have Pranipat, Pariprashna, and Seva. All these things are important. And then we get the mercy, then we get the knowledge. By surrendering, then the devotee gives proper knowledge and proper mercy. So, transmission of knowledge is based upon respect and inquisitiveness and service. And if we disrespect, then we can't get knowledge. If we're not humble, we can't get knowledge. If we reject it, if we don't want the knowledge, we're not going to get it. So therefore, we can't advance. The source of Krishna's mercy is through the devotee. We reject the Vaishnava and don't respect, then how we can get the mercy? And if we don't get the mercy, how we can advance? So that is why the Vaishnava apparatus is considered serious. Because it's the main connection with spiritual life. That's how we get our connection with spiritual life, through the Vaishnava. And if we reject the Vaishnava, then very difficult to advance. We cannot advance. So that's the practical reason why it is a serious offense. We cut off the roots of our devotional service by Vaishnava aparad. The other reason, of course, is that Krishna gets offended by the whole process of offending the devotee, because Krishna is dedicated to the devotee. So if you offend the devotee, it's worse than offending Krishna. Krishna is more offended when you offend the devotee than when he gets offended. When you offend him, it's not so bad as if you offend as a devotee. So if Durvasa offends Ambarish, that is worse than if Durvasa offends Vishnu. Vishnu will take it. The offense against Ambarish is worse than the offense against himself. This is another reason why the Vaishnava apparatus is very bad. Krishna doesn't like it. He's not pleased at all. Now, the Vaishnava, of course, is very humble anyway, and he doesn't take offenses generally. He doesn't become disturbed by all the things around him, like Jalabharat. Everybody was doing everything around him and making fun of him. He didn't care. Generally, the devotee doesn't care for the offenses. He's indifferent to the offenses that are committed against him in the material world. But that is not a reason, therefore, say it doesn't matter if we offend the devotees because they're above, you know, getting disturbed. That's not a good excuse, because Krishna becomes disturbed. Krishna takes it the other way. So we can't use that as an excuse. The effect will come whether the devotee is disturbed or not, the bad effect on us will come. We will have to bear the effect of that offense. One, the devotion, the mercy stops. We don't get any more mercy, so therefore we cannot advance. Yeah? Secondly, the Lord himself is offended by this, and then he's not pleased. So if the Lord is not pleased, then in that way the mercy stops also. So then the worst problem comes is that not only the mercy stops, but whatever has been accumulated in terms of devotion also begins to dissolve. This is the worst effect. Everything dissolves. Whatever you've accomplished dissolves. And if it's a serious aparata, it could go back to zero. That's the mad elephant offense. And the effects of the offense are subtle and long-lasting. The other things like karmas, they get dissolved more quickly as we go through the different stages in Arjuna-vritti. Then things get down, and then nishta, more karmas are dissolved, desires are dissolved. And by ruchi and asakti, gone. So by bhava state, no more karmas left. But the effect of aparas continues even after that into bhava. So there's a trace even in bhava of aparad, that aparad can still affect. The effects of aparad can still linger there. So that is the case with Bharat. The little trace was still there. And because of that, then he got some attachment in his heart, and due to that, then he thought of the deer instead of Narayan. That caused him to fall from his position. So therefore the effect of aparad can be quite subtle and long-lasting, and it can hold on even to higher stages of bhakti and to bhava. So it's quite a serious affair. Therefore one has to be very, very careful, particularly of this aparad. And it becomes serious when it is direct hostility involved, towards the malice or hostility involved. And then it can be very destructive. So that is what is pointed out here in text 5. Being situated in his original Krishna conscious position, a pure devotee does not identify with the body. Such a devotee should not be seen from a materialist point of view. Indeed, one should overlook a devotee's having a body, born in a low family, a body with a bad complexion, a deformed body, or a diseased or infirm body. According to ordinary reasons, such imperfections may seem prominent in the body of a pure devotee, but despite such seeming defects, the body of a pure devotee cannot be polluted. It is exactly like the waters of the Ganges, which sometimes, during the rainy season, are full of bubbles, foam, and mud. The Ganges water does not become polluted. Those who are advanced in spiritual understanding will bathe in the Ganges without considering the condition of the water. So just as the Ganges apparently looks like it has faults in it, but it is actually pure, so again, the devotee also, the pure devotee, is beyond fault. And whatever apparent faults are there, and from our materialistic vision, are actually not faults. As the devotees advance, it is more difficult to understand. In prema particularly, Rupa Goswami says, one cannot understand the activities of a person in prema. He gives qualities, devotee and sadhana bhakti, and what he should do and what he should not do, all this. And in prema and in bhava, he describes the lakshanas, the qualities of the devotee. He's always engaged in chanting and is attracted to hearing, and he lives in the holy dham, and I guess some things like that. And when it gets to premises, no one can understand his activities because they may be quite contradictory to what we expect of them. It may be surprising what he may do, and it may contradict everything we think a devotee should do. So we can't understand what that devotee's up to. So very, very difficult to understand. So therefore, we may criticize, and then it's destructive for us. And even on Baba, Rupa Goswami says that one should not criticize that person, even if there is offense, even if there's fault or apparent fault. And we should not criticize. He says it's like criticizing the spots on the moon. The moon has spots, so we can say, oh, the moon is not so beautiful after all. It's got those spots on if you look in a telescope. So, if we look closely, we'll see the faults. But generally, we appreciate the moon because it is beautiful. It gives light and it's cooling, etc. It has many good qualities to it. So, similarly with the person on Bhava, he's attained a very, very high stage. Even if it's not absolutely pure, it is almost pure. It is 99.9% pure. So that's very rare. It's an exalted state. And therefore, if there's an apparent fault there, it is nothing in comparison to what he's attained. And therefore, we should not criticize. So even Bharat, if he fell down, we cannot criticize. Because he's under the Lord's mercy anyway, at that point. And the Lord will take care of him. And he'll correct his position and he'll achieve higher state later on. So we cannot in any way criticize. So on those states, therefore, we have to be very, very careful. In those higher stages, very careful of how we see those devotees. In spite of the external appearances or external actions. Okay. In India, of course, there is a problem there because everyone is ingrained with the high and low in terms of family. It's quite strong there. Of course, even it is in the Western world to some degree, also high and low is also, there's some distinction there in England, maybe particularly with accents even. You got the wrong accent. You get branded as low or high class, you know? So in India, it is also particular, and even in spiritual things, they distinguish the Brahmin as better than the Sudra or anyone else, you know? And outcasts, of course, no, that's definitely... You know, we can't give the same respect, even if he's a devotee. And even if he's an exalted devotee, we have to put him in a separate class. And even among the Sri Vaishnavas, generally the respect is given to the Brahmin, who's done some, you know, good activities and he's got knowledge, etc. And if someone from a lower caste attains the same, let's say, level of knowledge and whatever in terms of scripture and speaking, whatever, still he's separate. They don't eat together. He's separately. We've got some distinctions there, yeah? So that distinction is very strong. In spite of the fact that Ramanuja himself was quite against it, apparently, because one of his gurus was from low class, and then his wife actually disrespected that guru, and therefore he left the wife. He was quite against it, and then he initiated many, like, out-of-caste people who weren't even in the Sudras. You know, he initiated them and allowed them, you know, to take up the process of Vaishnavism, etc. So he was quite against it, but even now in the Vaishnava Samhita, we'll find this kind of caste consciousness there, you know, in different groups. And he's mentioning here that one should not see in terms of body, which means in terms of caste, in terms of a complexion, in terms of color, in terms of defects, etc. On a superficial level, we should not see that. And instead, we should see qualification according to knowledge and devotion. What is his... He should be in a sampradaya. He should have proper knowledge, and he should have devotion to the Lord, attachment to the Lord, and detachment from material things. And then we can judge his qualification. So anyway, this is the aparad. One should be very, very careful of aparad. So then Rupa Goswami, he gives, after going through these preliminary things, you know, the basis, ultimately with the importance of association and how to deal with it and avoiding aparads, then finally he comes to the actual process of bhakti. What is the association for? The association is ultimately so we can do sadhana and practice. So in the next verse, as text 7, he discusses the sadhana. The holy name, character, pastimes, and activities of Krishna are all transcendentally sweet like sugar candy. Although the tongue of one afflicted by the jaundice of avidya, or ignorance, cannot taste anything sweet, it is wonderful that simply by carefully chanting these sweet names every day, a natural relish awakens within his tongue, and his disease is gradually destroyed at the root. So this is the process of sadhana bhakti. We have the holy name, which is non-different from Krishna, and Krishna is sweet and spiritual. But when we take the name, it is not so sweet. We don't experience it. So that is compared to a diseased condition. If you have jaundice and your liver is afflicted, then if you eat sugar candy, it does not taste sweet. It tastes bitter. Everybody else tastes it sweet, but if you're sick, it does not taste sweet. So similarly, the holy name is sweet for everybody who's spiritually advanced. But for one who's not spiritually advanced, then it does not taste sweet. So we're like sick people. People in the material world are sick. That is, they are covered by avidya, ignorance, rejection of Krishna. So therefore, chanting the name does not taste sweet. So that's the beginning position of the jiva. We do sadhana, but it is not so sweet. So that means we have to practice. But by continually taking the sugar candy when you've got jaundice, then gradually the sugar helps cure the disease, the liver problem, and then your taste begins to come back to normal again, and gradually you taste sweetness. So the sugar candy, which was bitter, is the cause of your cure. And if you taking that bitter thing, even though it doesn't taste so sweet, it tastes nice, doesn't taste nice, gradually it cures you and it begins to taste nice. So the sugar candy is the cure, actually. And then you can taste it later on and relish it. In the same way, we start off in ignorance, and sadhana does not seem so wonderful. It is difficult for us to do, including chanting. But by doing it repeatedly, just like taking medicine repeatedly, then gradually we become cured of our disease. And then we begin to relish it. So we begin to relish the holy name as we get cured of our material disease, as we lose our material attraction and we develop attraction for Krishna. Then the holy name becomes sweeter and we become more attracted to it. So one who's cured of jaundice, then it is not difficult for him to eat the sugar candy. He'll eat it with great relish. He doesn't have to be forced to eat it. So in the same way, if one advances in devotional service, then he doesn't have to force himself to chant or do any of the devotional process. He wants to do them naturally. And so it's not a practice anymore, actually. It is out of enthusiasm he does it. So that is a preferable stage. But you can't get to that stage unless you do the practice. You cannot get cured unless you take the sugar candy, which is bitter and which you don't like to take. But by taking it with your intelligence and saying it's going to cure me eventually, then eventually you get cured. So this is the process of Vaidhi Bhakti. By our intelligence, we understand that what the scripture says is true, that we're in the material world, we're in ignorance and we're suffering, and we've got to get cured, and there's a certain process to follow. So we have faith, and with faith we believe what the scripture says, and then with our intelligence we say, okay, we have to control our senses, and we have to do the certain process, and we do it. So that is Vaidhi Bhakti. Based upon the rules and regulations of Shastra, we conduct our activities. So through this process, gradually, one will develop the taste. In terms of the stages of the bhakti, this is bhajana kriya, devotional activities, that's eating the candy. Anarkana vritti is gradually curing the disease. And then we get nishta. And then ruchi. Ruchi is where we actually get the taste. And asakti is where we cannot give it up anymore. We ought to take more and more candy. And bhava is when we realize Krishna. So, gradually more and more attraction, and Krishna gives himself to the devotee. So, this is the process we have to follow. In the beginning, we have to do it by using our intelligence, control the senses, and regularly practice. So the previous things were there, things favorable for bhakti and controlling the senses, the tongue and the stomach and the anger and desire and speech, etc. We have to control these things, and we have to have proper attitudes like enthusiasm, patience, and faith. And then we have to do this. And we have, these are the positive items of devotional service. We have to chant the holy name daily. Not only the holy name, but his holy name, character, and that is the Krishna Nama Charita Adi. Charita means, of course, activities and qualities. So we have to hear and chant about the name, form, qualities, and activities of the Supreme Lord. Hearing and chanting. And gradually it will become more attractive to us as we go on. And purify us, and then we get out of the material world. So this is the process we have to follow. So that's Vaidhi Bhakti. Then he goes higher than that in the next verse, that's text 8. And here he goes into Raganuga Bhakti. The essence of all advice is that one should utilize one's full time, 24 hours a day, in nicely chanting and remembering the Lord's divine name, transcendental form, qualities, and eternal pastimes, thereby gradually engaging one's tongue and mind. So speaking, hearing, thinking about the Lord. In this way, one should reside in Vraja, Goloka Vrindavan Dham, and serve Krishna under the guidance of devotees. One should follow in the footsteps of the Lord's beloved devotees who are deeply attached to his devotional service. That anuragi, jan anugami. As one advances, then one becomes more absorbed in the activities because it becomes tasty. One wants to do it more and more. One doesn't force oneself. It becomes more spontaneous, and one does it out of attachment. So that's why it says here that one should fully engage one's time in hearing and chanting 24 hours a day. And not by force, this is by taste. One develops a taste and one does this. One can go in two directions there. One can go towards, one can continue in Vaidhi Bhakti, or one can go into what's called Raganuga Bhakti. Raganuga Bhakti is dedicated solely to Vrindavan Krishna, in the mood of sweetness. And any other form of Krishna or any other form of the Lord, of Vishnu or whatever, that goes into the Vaidhi Bhakti process. So one can continue in Vaidhi Bhakti in Ruchi, Asakti, Bhava, and Prema, and get to the highest stage of Prema, also by Vaidhi Bhakti. But then, of course, the experience is a little different. One has an experience of awe and reverence, etc., and realization of the Lord, even in Prema. The other process is that you become attached, and if you have the qualification for Raganuga is a great greed, a greed to attain, great desire to attain this type of spontaneous love, like the inhabitants of Vrindavan. So one has that great greed, then one follows the path of Raganuga. And if one doesn't, then one follows the path of Vaidhi Bhakti and goes to Bhava and Prema. So therefore, the two, one does not necessarily lead to the other. They're like parallel paths, more or less, and they can both attain to the top stage. But if one doesn't have that greed for Vraja Prema, then one must do Vaidhi Bhakti. So that is why we generally advise Vaidhi Bhakti for everybody in the beginning. If they develop that greed later on, okay, they can follow. So, here he's discussing this, what turns into Raganuga Bhakti. And some of the qualities of Raganuga, one follows after the inhabitants of Vraja, the Nitya Siddhas, that is, Yasoda, Nanda, the gopis, the cowherd boys. One has a particular attraction there. One follows after them, becomes deeply attached to those devotees and follows their, becomes absorbed in their, the way they serve Krishna. Mm-hmm. And we try to follow that, the same type of service, which is very spontaneous. And one generally becomes attached to living in Vrindavan. There's another quality of one in Raghunath. He's attached to living there. And he becomes, he does external services as in Vaidhi Bhakti, he will hearing and chanting. That's why it says here, he does it 24 hours a day. glorifying the Lord, etc. However, he also develops mind, remembrance of the Lord, meditation on the Lord. So therefore it says here, but gradually he absorbs his tongue and his mind in the Lord's divine name and pastimes, etc. So the mental activities and meditation become more prominent in the Raghunuga Bhakti. And there is specific stages also that are mentioned here. We've got stages mentioned here. Shravana Dasa, Shravana Dasa, Yushabhava, gradual absorption. Using the mind, and gradually one just ends up leaving the material body and going into the spiritual world. That's the last stage, final stage, perfection. This verse is explaining the process of Raghunuga, where one begins to absorb the mind in pastimes of Krishna and follow the footsteps of the people of Vraja. So the remaining texts, 9, 10, and 11, are the glorification of the Dham. In the previous verse, Rupa Goswami mentioned that one resides in Vraja. Tishtan Vraja, one resides in Vraja. Now, if you cannot reside in Vraja, the alternative is you meditate on it. Because everybody cannot reside in the holy Dham. So therefore you should meditate on the holy Dham and everything in the holy Dham. Anyway, the last verses are glorification of the Dhamma, but through that Rupa Goswami actually is glorifying Radha. Radharani. So he does a little indirectly. So he begins by starting on the outskirts, more or less. And then gradually focusing and focusing and focusing and focusing and focusing until he gets to the highest place and then the highest type of devotee also. So he begins by glorifying Mathura. And he says Mathura is better than Vaikuntha. Now, better doesn't mean in the sense that one is spiritual, one is material, one is more spiritual than the other. They're all spiritual. All the Dhammas are spiritual. Vaikuntha is fully spiritual and it also has prema. So it's not a bit better in that sense. It's not because one is material and one is spiritual. They're all spiritual. It is better in the sense of rasa, in the variety of love that exists. And Vaikuntha is characterized by only dasya rasa in Aishwarya mode. We receive God as God, and we worship Him with great respect. Whereas in Mathura and Raja, there is that becomes less and less. But still in Mathura, there is an awareness of God. Because Devaki and Vasudeva, they saw Krishna as Narayana also. They know He's God. But they also have great affection for Krishna. So it's a mixture then. So it's superior to Vaikuntha, but it's, still it's not the same as Raja. In the Nectar of Devotion there, Rupa Goswami says that Dwarka is perfect, Purna. But Mathura is more perfect, Purnatara. But Raja is most perfect, Purnatama. So they're all spiritual, but nevertheless, there is intensity of love. And it's most intense in Raja. And in Dwarka, it is less intense. Everybody there is, Krishna is a king, and it's a little formal there. And Mathura, he's not a king yet, he's in between. And it got a little spontaneity there, but it's not as much as in Raja. And so it's like intermediary. So it's a little better than Raja, but then Raja's even better. It's most perfect. So that's what is represented here by showing the dhammas. So better than Vaikuntha is Mathura. At least Krishna is there. But superior to Mathura is the transcendental forest of Vrindavan, because Krishna had his Rasa-lila there. Of course, actually we can take the whole Mathura Mandala as including all the whole area, of which Mathura is one portion. So we can say the whole area is very nice, the Vrindavan Mathura area. But then the best part of that is, of the 12 forests, is the Vrindavan forest. That's the best one. Why? Because there Krishna performed Rasa-lila within Vrindavan. And the Rasa-lila is considered to be as far as Bhagavan was concerned, the most spectacular exhibition of Krishna's rasa. Of all the different rasas and the Madhurya rasa, this is the ultimate display of rasa, the Rasa-lila. So therefore it's considered superior because that's where his pastimes took place. But within this Vrindavan also, then there is also Govardhan Hill. And this is considered superior part of Vrindavan. Of Vrindavan, and the essence of Vrindavan actually is in Govardhan Hill, which was raised by Krishna's hand. But not only that, it was actually the site of Krishna's intimate pastimes also. And there's rivers, waterfalls, caves, forests on Govardhan Hill. So Krishna had many intimate pastimes there with his friends, that's the Sakas, but also with the gopis, particularly with Radharani. So that's considered even higher because there's some association with Radharani. And above all, the super excellent Sri Radha Kund stands supreme, for it is overflooded with the ambrosial nectarian prema of the Lord of Gokul Sri Krishna. Where then is that intelligent person who's unwilling to serve this divine Radha Kund, which is situated at the foot of Govardhan Hill? So we have Mathura, and we have Vrindavan, and then we have Govardhan, and then we have Radha Kund. So go right in Govardhan is Radha Kund. It's like the Radha Kund and Shyama Kund are like the eyes. The Govardhan Hill is kind of shaped like a peacock, kind of long, and the peacock and a head, and then Radha Kund and Shyama Kund are like the eyes. So ultimately, of all places, then ultimately the prema is most condensed in Radha Kund. It is there generally in the Vrindavan area, Mathura, and then more in the Vrindavan area, more in Govardhan, and then ultimately most in the Radha Kund area. This is the place of Radha's Kund. Lord Chaitanya, when he came to Vrindavan area, he wandered in the forests, 12 forests, which were not well demarcated at that time. Later on, Lord Chaitanya ordered the Goswamis to find all the holy places there in the holy dham, the forests and the different kundas and the different places like the ghats, etc. And then build temples, etc. He ordered them to do that because they were all lost. Basically, there were a few villages there, simple villages in that area. So when Lord Chaitanya came, before the Goswamis even came there, it was all like wild area. But he wandered around in all those forests around Mathura and Vrindavan area. And at one time he came to this pool of water, and then he went into ecstasy. He got ecstatic symptoms on his body and became full of joy. And then he said, this is Radha Kund. This is the
Kunda of Radharani. And he went into ecstasy there at that point. Huh? So, of course, he was ecstasy everywhere, but when he went there, then was more ecstatic. So ever since that time, then that Kunda has been worshipped as the essence of prema. Not just prema, but Radha's prema. So all devotees of Krishna, Radha is considered the supreme devotee, and her love is considered to be the most excellent and most intense. And that is represented in her kunda itself, and that's also considered to be the kunda of prema. So therefore is glorified. Her love is glorified by glorifying her kunda. Okay, so then in the next verse, he goes to the different levels of activities. In Shastra, it is said that of all types of fruit of workers, he who is advanced in knowledge of higher values of life is favored by the Supreme Lord Hari. In other words, karma. And if you got jnana, it's better. Out of many people who are advanced in knowledge, one who is practically liberated by virtue of his knowledge may take to devotional service. He is superior to others. So the bhakta is superior to the jnani. However, one who has actually attained prema, pure love of Krishna, is superior to him. So among the devotees, the devotee who has gone beyond sadhana and has reached prema, the final stage, he is considered to be superior. The gopis are exalted above all the advanced devotees because they are also always totally dependent upon Sri Krishna, the transcendental cowherd boy. So among all perfected devotees in prema, then the gopis are the best. And among the gopis, Srimati Radharani is the most dear to Krishna. So then gopis are most dear, but among the gopis, and the most dear of the gopis is Radha. Her kunda, or lake, is as profoundly dear to Lord Krishna as this most beloved of the gopis. Who then will not reside at Radha Kunda and as spiritual bodies are charged with ecstatic devotional feelings, render loving service to the divine couple Sri Radha Govinda, who perform their Astakalya Lila, their eternal eightfold daily pastimes. Indeed, those who execute devotional service on the banks of Radha Kunda are the most fortunate people in the universe. So therefore he's pointing out here the devotees ultimately superiority in certain terms of intensity of love, and ultimately Radha is at the top, and then her kunda is equal to Radha. So then this is also very dear to Krishna. So therefore one should be in the holy dham, one should be in Vrindavan, one should be in Govardhan, but ultimately if one is in Radha Kunda, that is the most powerful place to be in. Radha Prem. So it mentions here about the Astakalya Lila. One should meditate on the Astakalya Lila. That means Krishna has pastimes. And the pastimes, these are regular pastimes that occur every day. Just like everyone here has most people have a job. So every day you get up and you do a certain thing, and then you go out and then you go to your job, and then you take your meal at a certain time, you have a lunch break at a certain time, you have a coffee break at a certain time, then you go home and then you can do your certain things. So you get a regular schedule every day to follow. So Krishna also has a regular schedule in the spiritual world. His pastimes go on like this, every day. So his day is divided up into 8 parts. Not always equal. Some parts in the middle, I think, are longer. But 8 parts. Out of 24 hours, we get 8 parts. Starting in the early morning when Krishna wakes up. And then he goes and milks the cows and does other things. And then he comes back and Mother Yasoda bathes him and dresses him and everything. Then he eats along with the cowherd boys. They all sit down and they all eat. And after eating, then the cowherd boys and Krishna, they go out and gather all the cows and calves together. and they take him into the fields. And that's getting into the morning, late morning by then. They go out into the fields and they play for some time. And then they have noon pastimes where they sit down and have a picnic together. And then there's afternoon pastimes where they play. But meantime, Krishna disappears. And he disappears and he goes out and meets Radha and the gopis in the meantime, in the, after lunch or during lunchtime. And then he returns later on. And then there's late afternoon pastimes with the gopas, and then they return home. And then when Krishna returns home, that's the evening. And then he has, then he bathes again and takes his meal with Nanda Maharaj. And then he relaxes for some time. And then he goes to bed. Or he pretends to go to bed. Then in the middle of the night he gets up again and goes out and he goes into the forest and he meets the gopis, and then they have pastimes at midnight there, and that's the final pastime. And then after that, then he goes to sleep with Radharani, and then when before the day breaks they get up and they run back home. So it's 8 parts of the day like that, and that's in the spiritual world. It rotates like that every day. And so when they say Astakali or Leela, that's the Leelas that happen in the 8 parts of the day. So when in Raghunuga Bhakti, then he meditates on the pastimes with Radha and Krishna at the different times of the day. His day goes on, then he meditates on these different pastimes all day long. So what is indicated here is in Radha Kund, this is the ideal place to do this. And because this is where the pastimes of Radha and Krishna took place, a lot of the pastimes, the intimate pastimes took place. So then one should go to Radha Kund, and one should meditate on all these different pastimes daily. So one of them becomes absorbed in that meditation, one then begins to serve in one's siddha deha, in one's spiritual body. One begins to serve in those pastimes in meditation, and one gets completely absorbed in that, then that is considered perfection. And then one gives up one's material body and one enters into the spiritual world in that body and serves in the spiritual world. Last verse. Of the many objects of favored delight and of all the lovable damsels of Rajabhumi, Srimati Radharani is certainly the most treasured object of Krishna's love. And in every respect, her divine kunda is described by great sages as similarly dear to him. Undoubtedly, Radha Kunda is very rarely attained even by the great devotees. Therefore, it is even more difficult for ordinary devotees to attain. If one simply bathes once within those holy waters, one's pure love of Krishna is fully aroused. So this is a final glorification of Radha Kund and of Srimati Radharani and her love for Krishna. So in this way, this is a very short work, and it starts out with very basic things. That is, you know, control your senses and all this. And then sadhu sangha, then avoiding aparads, following the process of Vaidhi Bhakti, going to Raghunuga Bhakti, and finally attaining Prema. And not only Prema, but Prema in Vraja and in association of Radha and Krishna. So that's what he's pointing out as the highest goal. So this contains the, you can say, the, in a very short way, the from the beginning stage to the final stages of devotion according to the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. Okay, question.
Qualifications, Raghunuga Bhakti and Vaidhi Bhakti, and Raghunuga is like Raja and Krishna.
Yeah.
If one has an interest in Lord Chaitanya and Mayapur Puri and so on, on the Vaidhi path, or is that a comparable?
Well, they don't, it's not actually not Vaidhi Bhakti also with Lord Chaitanya. I don't know, somebody asked that question, which is it Raghunuga or not? And it kind of is like Raghunuga, but it's the definition of Raghunuga given in the Nectar of Devotion is only for Krishna and to follow after the inhabitants of Raja. So it doesn't fit that definition exactly. So nevertheless, we say that Lord Chaitanya is non-different from Krishna, and he's also Radha at the same time, taking the identity of Radha when he comes in this material world. So it is something like this, and therefore Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that in the spiritual world, you can attain a dual form to participate in the pastimes of Radha Krishna and simultaneously in the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya.
because they're so close together in mood. They're slightly different, so therefore Krishna's pastimes are called Madhurya, and Lord Chaitanya's pastimes are called Audorja. But they're close enough together that one can have simultaneously two bodies to enjoy in both pastimes. There is also a sadhana, there's some sadhana there to meditate on Lord Chaitanya and his Astakaliya Leela also sorts a little different from this, because it's Kirtan Leela. Basically he goes out and does Kirtan and does different things. Huh? For all of Lord Chaitanya's activities in Navadvipa, there's also an equivalent in Vraja. When Lord Chaitanya does Sankirtan with his devotees, that is considered to be equivalent to the Ras Leela, actually. So that it's kind of very similar, but in a different form. So we can say it's like Raganuga and that. Of course, Lord Chaitanya, we also say that we cannot worship independently. We're going to worship Lord Chaitanya. We have to worship Radha Krishna also. And if we worship Radha Krishna, we have to worship Lord Chaitanya. So I think the two are simultaneous. So if one is doing Raghunuga Bhakti, then one would also worship Lord Chaitanya. And we can't worship Lord Chaitanya without Radha Krishna also. So yeah, probably it becomes the same thing as Raghunuga ultimately. Though the mood is slightly different.
Full understanding of this, that's kind of what I mean to support it. So it seems like, at least today, devotees are very eager to go to Radha Kund and take part and, you know, gesture. So, I mean, what if these other great souls can't properly approach Radha Kund? I mean, what's the meaning of, you know, like
going there. the message is that we're more fortunate than they are, in one sense. But of course, we should never underestimate the greatness of Narada Muni also. And of course, the other aspect is that though we may go there, do we have the eyes to see it and appreciate it? So Bhaktivinoda mentions in relation to Navadvipa Dham, you can go to that Dham, but you're not necessarily there at the same time. If you have material eyes or material consciousness, you won't see the Dham or appreciate it in the same way. So therefore you don't get the effect of it. Even though the Dham is purifying and, you know, the stepping in the Dham, then you're liberated and all this, but it won't happen if you've got material eyes, material consciousness. So therefore one go to Radha Kund, go there, but then one should be qualified also and have proper devotion. Then one will have the full effect. So if one has developed some love for Radha and Krishna, then if one goes there, they don't have very good potency. If one hasn't, therefore it won't have the same effect. It will have some effect, but not as much. But if one has developed already, then it will have great effect. And of course, this is meant to show that love of attaining realization of Radha Krishna's love is very rare for anyone, and to get access to that is very rare. And Lord Chaitanya makes it possible, otherwise not impossible. So if one gets Lord Chaitanya's mercy, then one is considered very fortunate, because we have an approach there. Even if it will take us many lifetimes, still we've got an approach. Whereas others don't get the mercy, very, very difficult for them to understand that love. So that is to make it easy for us to attain also.
How
can
you reconcile this statement with
Aparadha? Yeah, Aparadha is the exception. So normally, it's not like
pap and punya, which are exhausted by enjoying or suffering them. Huh? I have a karma, and I can expend the karma by suffering. Huh? Or I get a punya, and I enjoy it, then I lose it. Finish, I'm back to zero again. So in that sense, we do devotional service. The effect of devotional service is not lost in the future by enjoyment or anything like that. It continues. And we can do more devotional service. And it's not lost simply by living in the material world, as karmas are expended by enjoying or suffering. In that sense, it's not lost. But it can be destroyed by aparad. That's the thing. Not by pap and punya. Pap and punya cannot affect it, but aparad can affect it. Of course, pap and punya, pap can be aparad also in the sense of committing offense in the strength of the holy name. Then it becomes aparad also. Papa becomes aparad there. Huh? But if it's this aparad, or offense, sin committed accidentally, so to speak, then that does not interfere with your bhakti. Does not destroy your bhakti.
You didn't seems like every day.
Well, it's not exactly the same thing. The schedule is there, and those are the general things, but he doesn't do exactly the same thing and say exactly the same thing every day. It's just that the general plan is there, that he wakes up and then he, you know, goes out and milks the cows and comes back and bathes and eats like that. But there's obviously many variations there. Yeah? And then he goes out and herds the cows and has pastimes. But there's always variation every day.
Isn't it?
At night, go out and do what? Have a party? not mentioned. But they could be involved in some of the pastimes, because we know that some of the gopas are also involved in sending messages back and forth and having counter plots here and there, whatever. So these plots are also going on in the day also. Even in the daytime, some of the gopas are involved with Krishna also in, you know, the meeting with Radharani and avoiding the different, you know, obstacles on the path, like, you know, Chandravali, etc. They all have some role to play there. So every day there's some differences there. It's not the general, you know, activities are there, but within that they have their pastimes, which are different every day.
On the question of terms of if it's out of duty, one is given, let's say, the role to play, and out of duty, he had to find out the mistake of someone or somebody or some person.
Mm-hmm.
So would that consider an
opera? Oh, well, it depends on whether it's true or not, for one thing. Whether it's done out of malice or whatever, whatever. If it's done out of good intentions, then there's no problem. Huh? But still, nevertheless, we have to be careful that we try not to disturb the person in the process.
Mm. So come back to the relationship with the person, isn't it?
Yeah. And proper respect, maybe we can say. Respect should be there in that case anyway. Mm. Some sort of respect should be there.
So for those, like, if I'm wrong, say that if someone or observer between a Vaishnava and Vaishnava are then committing each other due to an activity or whatever, it's because they didn't see Krishna behind the situation.
Yeah, if we don't have faith in Krishna's hand, generally we, you know, if we use material logic to try to explain things, then we don't accept things in the same way. If we see Krishna's hand, then we more or less accept that. We don't become overly disturbed by what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But if we use material logic, then we can find all sorts of faults here and there, whatever.
So you can see that when something happens to us, that good or bad is due to activity we've done in the past. So now the Lord is just using this person or that person to give us a chance to overcome the situation.
Yeah, that's the devotional attitude we should take. And by doing so, we get mercy of Krishna. That's what the Bhagavatam says. That's how we should approach our position in the material world. Every obstacle should we take as that's what we deserve, because that's our karma, and that's mercy for us, and it's a sign. It's a chance for us to advance. So that's how we take it.
Another question I have is about the spiritual master, you know, after a money call. In the final lesson of Srila Prabhupada, when he passed away, a lot of people, he was beside his bed and, you know, massaging his leg, when he had his skin leave, all that. But the teaching of Prabhupada is, of course, for us to get an attachment or to serve Radha and Krishna. That's what he always teaches to see Krishna and attach to Krishna. So, if attachment to Guru, is it like, you know, in bodily form, or is it attachment to Krishna, which is the way to go? Is it to attach to Radha and Krishna, or is it attached to Guru, and then the Guru will bring us to Radha and Krishna?
The Guru is the representative of Krishna. Huh? And we have attachment to the, because actually we don't see Krishna.
Yeah.
Huh? We see the Guru, so we can be attached to him. But we cannot separate that from our attachment to Krishna. If we're going to attach to the Guru separately from Krishna, then it's no longer spiritual. Yeah? So it's only in relation to Krishna ultimately.
So then maybe you're attached to
Krishna. In other words, we can say he's a servant of Krishna. So we see him as a servant of Krishna, and that's why we're attached to him. Not separately from Krishna, but devoid of attachment to Krishna, then what's the use?
I see. So we still have to see that if there's a relationship.
Yeah.
And what is actually the relationship between the disciple and the guru? Is that like with Krishna, we all have rasa, different rasa in the end.
Uh-huh.
What about with guru?
In the material world, as far as when we're here and we're doing sadhana, then there is it's like dasya. Yeah, respect. Yeah, have respect.
In Vaishnava class, sometimes you can say female word, you okay, we can accept the assumption. But in the neighbor situation, no, okay, he actually, the man is not actually in any way, so he's committing offense to him.
Well, I think Vishwan Chakravarti has a comment on that, and he says that, you know, we should not use that as an excuse to commit aparad just because he's not so senior, he's not so advanced, therefore it doesn't count. So we should give respect to all living entities. That's one thing. And then among living entities, we should give respect to the Brahman and the cow and the Aswata tree of all things. And of course, more than that, the Tulsi tree, and to the Vaishnavas. And then among Vaishnavas, we should give mental respect to the inferior Vaishnava, one who has chanted Krishna's name once. And one who's more serious, then we should actually pay more respect. And to one who's more advanced, then we have to actually serve. So then the counter thing there is that, the other thing is that in any case, we shouldn't commit aparads against anybody. Even an ordinary living entity in the material world, we shouldn't disturb it. Whether it's animal or plant, even. What to speak of a Vaishnava and, you know, on different grades. You know. But the effect is more on the higher it goes. Huh? So the if you commit offense against a more advanced Vaishnava, of course, the effect is more serious than with an animal or a plant or whatever. But this effect in any case. But, it's more with the Vaishnava and it's most with the advanced Vaishnava.
Just to add on that, from the situation is, let's say to offer to the other living, any other jiva or whatsoever, is it because we did not see super soul residing in their heart that is controlling their activity due to their past desire? That's why we start to commit offense on that situation, on the person or whatever, because they might be taking meat, or might be talking nonsense, and then all these things. But because of his past desire, and just because he the super soul within the person, we straight away to commit offense if the person attacks us or criticizes us for any situation that arises.
You're talking about human beings, other human beings.
More than human beings.
Yeah.
Is it because we could not see? Or we don't identify the issues, the law is going to be tried in their heart to arrange their karma and so forth, their reactions happen.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to us again, you know, it's because of our past. Somehow, we see something in the past, and then it just comes back to us.
The idea with the other human beings and not disturbing them is actually, in general, if people have their karmas, people are at different levels.
and generally avoid preaching to the non-faithful. Huh? And Krishna says, don't disturb the minds of the ignorant. If they don't have faith and we can't produce faith, then leave them alone and let them go through the gunas gradually and work their way up that way. Krishna's got his plan for those people. Huh? And our efforts may not have effect on them. Huh? Indirectly, we can affect, that is, by Agyata Sukritis. If we engage them in Agyata Sukritis, that's beneficial for them. But that has to be done without their knowledge, because they don't want to do anything for Krishna. So that's about the only benefit we can do at that stage. But otherwise, to disturb them unnecessarily, that's not going to help out either. So best to avoid them then for in terms of devotional things. But nevertheless, they are living entities. And therefore, we don't unnecessarily disturb them. If they don't have faith, and we can't force that faith either. So then to preach to them is more of a disturbance than anything else. So. And it also make them commit aparad, so therefore we don't want that to happen also. So that's also disturbing for them. If they commit aparad, then that's also harmful for them. So we don't want to engage them in that such things, but we avoid that.
And just the point about the verse that it doesn't to chant always and they mentioned that you need to follow any purpose. You usually don't have a case, but if you do it regularly, sometimes it may look a bit mechanical.
Well, the prerequisite is faith, and therefore, when we execute the activity, at least we have to have some good intentions behind it. That is, we're trying to please Krishna with this. That much we should do, even if we can't develop more love or whatever. So we chant, and then we should have the intention of trying to please Krishna with that. That much we should do. Then it is called bhakti, at least. But if our mind is blank, we don't have any intentions, then it is much weaker in terms of devotional service.
What if you don't eat? Even if you don't feel that thing, if you like it, you want to follow the thing, because if you like to come to the program, if you like to go to the classes, how about that?
We like to.
Yeah.
But why we like? Because the food tastes good, or the whatever. serious bhakti, that is uttama bhakti, means we do it with a little knowledge, and then with a good intention. That is, faith is there, and we're trying to do it to please Krishna without any other desire. That's where Rupa Goswami draws the line between uttama bhakti and sadhana bhakti, which is the beginning stage of uttama bhakti, and everything else. Other people can do also. They can do what they want. Whatever we want to do, sadhana bhakti, according to his process, then it has to be activities with intentions of pleasing Krishna.
So then we chant Hare Krishna for the whole idea to please Krishna. But in the beginning, it is because we were told that we were pleasing Master to get a chance to sing down. So we just chant anyway because the Sri Master told us.
Yeah, or chant 16 rounds with intention of pleasing Krishna.
Monks cannot commit mental aparad.
Yes. Of course, when it becomes verbal or physical, then it's worse. But just to hold it in the mind also is not good, because then it will manifest eventually, probably, and we dwell on it. So one has to be careful of the mind also. It's not so serious as the others, but then again, it could develop later on.
And after Kaya Leela, you discovered the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's part of the divine entertainment, right? And all these eight activities are performed with Radha Kunda.
No. Different places, but I think in the noon pastimes where he goes away, usually that's near Radha Kunda.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when he goes up to herd the cows, generally it's towards Govardhan.
Like, the verse says Krishna's
That's no, we meditate. You go there and you meditate on Asta Kali Lila. Yeah. So you're residing there. So therefore we see some of the Bhajan Kutirs are there, some of the Goswamis. Yeah. Beside the bank there.
What should one would be, let's say one were to go to Radhakund and to one to stop there?
Sorry for Bhajan. Well, one should be qualified for it, basically. Yeah. I'm going to pay respect, yeah, but one should be careful not to commit offense in the process. We should be very careful doing that.
When we go to Radhakund, what should be our mode? Should we take bath in Radhakund?
Oh, you can sprinkle water on your head. I think it's the safest thing to do. Yes, some people do that also. They go in, but then I think it's safer just to sprinkle the water on. I think on the appearance day of Radhakund, everyone jumps in the river, jumps in the Kunda. But better safer just to sprinkle the water on the hand. More respect. Okay.